America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Do you need a dose of hope and possibility as the economy is submerged under the weight of inflation? Our guest on today's podcast has written a book of great significance. If you're a person who doesn't yet have your head in the cloud, it's imperative you do so. Give him and me 30 minutes of time, and just maybe you'll be convinced that, like the written word, the wheel — that'll never work, according to Larry David — the microchip, the smartphone, the cloud puts us at an economic inflection point. In fact, he thinks we're in the midst of a new roaring 20s. It's fascinating and invaluable information. That's next on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Mark Mills. And he's written a remarkable book, and I don't say that about each and every author that we bring to you, but this is truly something that you need to pay attention to. It's called The Cloud Revolution: How the Convergence of New Technologies Will Unleash the Next Economic Boom and a Roaring 2020s. And I've got to tell you that we preface this podcast by saying, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time. That's what our podcast looks at, trends. And I've got to tell you, this good news story that you put before us is just in time, because a lot of people are very concerned about the economics of the moment and worried that we're stuck in a place that is going to be very hard to dislodge from. And yet you say that the 2020s could be like the roaring 20s of the last century.
Yeah, I mean, your tagline for your podcast is spot on, and it is a little discordant to be writing an optimistic look at the 2020s, given where the world is right at the moment, right? Given what's happening in Ukraine and the inflationary pressures and our political tumults. I get it. I mean, it sort of seems like I'm the proverbial tilting at windmills perspective, I guess. But look. The point I make in my book, as you know, is that politics do matter, and they, you know, governments, how we govern ourselves, it's incredibly important. And, you know, economies can be destroyed by governments, by potentates and politicians. Or put simplistically, it's possible to Sovietize pretty much any economy. It's possible. Look at Venezuela. You know, look what happened to Russia for the 20th century. So, I'm not unaware of that. At the same time, you know, to look at where things can go and probably will go, say, in the next decade or two, you have to look beyond the moment. You can't assume we're going to be in a sort of political, depending, doesn't matter where you are politically, politics is always chaotic. And we go through episodes of real challenges, wars and revolutions. I mean, but through all of human history, if you look over the span, we know the obvious, right? Things have gotten better. People are becoming wealthier and healthier on average. And it's been an incredible, incredible uplift of human well-being and wealth of the 20th century. And the question you'd have to ask yourself is, was that a one-time deal? I mean, that's it? No, the future is a future of sort of low growth and political chaos. And that's the, quote, new normal. And I call these people the new normalists. or you know, is there another upwelling of opportunity? I think there is. I think the evidence is clear, and I don't do it, as you know, from a hand waving perspective. Just have faith, things will get better. The perspective that I'd like to bring to this question about our near future is, yes, you have to have faith, because faith in the future, confidence, optimism, that's what entrepreneurship is about. That's how we, you know, run our lives. But you'd want to know, you know, what's going to be different about the future from the past or our present? And is it like 1920? If you think about 1920s, the things that animated the entire 20th century had already been invented by 1920, but they weren't really in widespread use. Electrification was still low. Very few people had a car. The radio had not been invented as a home product. It had been invented as a commercial industrial device more than two decades earlier. Pharmaceuticals really didn't exist, but the chemistry revolution had begun 20 years earlier. If you think about, and airplanes had been invented, right? But there was almost no air travel, of course, in 1920, certainly not like we think of it. So all those things had just been recently invented right around 1920. They matured, became practical. By mature, I mean commercially viable, affordable. And those technologies propelled the entire 20th century, the car, the airplane, pharmaceuticals, and advent of new materials, plastics, polymers, and, of course, aviation. Big changes. A lot of economists say that's it. They're all one-time deals. Once you invent the airplane, you can't invent it again. Well, no kidding. Once you invent a car, you can't invent it again. Well, this is, to use a technical term, no duh. But do we really think that everything that could be invented has already been invented? And I don't mean apps for your smartphone, but there's nothing really new. Obviously, the question answers itself, but what I try to do in my book is be specific. These are the kinds of things that are new that have recently been invented. This is the key to predicting, I think, the future.
What I think is fascinating is that you remind us, I mean, just by virtue of the title of your book, The Cloud Revolution, you say that the cloud is this infrastructure unlike any that we've ever seen built, whether it was with asphalt and concrete or today, in terms of moving goods and services and helping to transform this economy using a triple decker, if you will, effect of technologies. You've got to really get us into this, because I think many of us, when we think about the cloud, it's a place we can go if we've lost our photos or lost a document. I mean, we're thinking of it in such a low-grade term. You've really got to help us understand what you're saying here.
Thank you for that. That's a good point. And, of course, I began with the cloud because the infrastructure of the cloud is so remarkable, and we take it for granted. And we're in the early days. So the cloud, let's define what I mean by that, is different from the Internet. And everybody knows what we mean when we say the Internet, because – you know, most of us have been around and use the Internet, but the cloud is as different from the Internet as the Internet was different from telephony, from telephones. And by that, I mean, we all do what the cloud we daily take advantage of what the cloud can do for things other than storing pictures, right? We all know if you take a picture, it can be remotely stored and you can access it. And isn't that nice and convenient? It's actually a pretty big deal, but it's not like the invention of the car, right? It's convenient. But what we use the cloud for is not communications. The cloud uses the communications infrastructure. It uses the Internet. What the cloud does is something more than just computing, more than communicating. It provides, let's be simplistic, it provides advice that's useful. So when you use a mapping program like Google Maps or Apple Maps, whatever, you're asking for advice. What's the best way for me to go from A to B? You're not looking for a map. You know, we all become very accustomed to the fact that in real time, the cloud, and that's what's going on through sensors and cars and knowing where traffic is, cameras, and through the connectivity we have, it's real time, always everywhere. But what we ask for is advice on the best route given the reality of traffic conditions. And you don't just get a route, you get, here's some options, right? That's advice. That is a revolution. We all know that because those of us of a certain age grew up, you know, with paper maps trying to figure out how to get places. But imagine having that same capability, and this is where it's difficult, and this is where the world is going. Well, for supply chains, so we all know what supply chains are now. You're a retailer. You're You sell something, whether it's clothes or food, and your supply chain is complex and labyrinthine, you know, leaks, goes way off in invisible ways into the ecosystem of industries. Wouldn't it be nice if you're at the other end of it, you're the business owner, if you could ask an equivalent question, if I want to sell something, order something, buy something, that what's the industrial traffic like? What's the availability of the materials? What all the complex things that go into providing the product that you want to sell or the service you want to have? Those data are available, and they can be interrogated in ways that are very similar to how we ask, what's the best route I should take when I'm driving somewhere? That kind of efficiency is unprecedented in history. That kind of sort of visibility on manufacturing and agriculture is just now beginning to penetrate into those markets. Productivity is the key to wealth. You want more output that's higher quality at lower cost with fewer inputs. That's the textbook definition of productivity. That's what creates wealth. That's why people have the money to educate, entertain, have travel and tourism. And that's where the revolution lies. The infrastructure of the cloud is unique, and it's huge. I mean, let's put it in money, hardware money terms, mm-hmm. because to illustrate how big it is. I mean, it's invisible. We don't see it. We don't see the electricity network really until you see power lines occasionally. But right now, the global spending on hardware to build out the cloud infrastructure is greater than global spending on hardware for the electric utility industry. And it's growing faster because the uses for electricity, the number of things that we can do with electricity are growing slowly with population and some new gadgets and devices. But the uses for cloud, for information, for advice, from medical advice to shopping advice to travel advice to personal investing advice, all those features that the cloud allows you because it's inferential as opposed to computational. There's essentially an infinite demand for those kinds of services. So if you think about what the cloud can yet do, what we have is a infrastructure that has changed how we bank. Everybody, lots of people around the world bank from their phones, the smartphones. It's changed how we get our news. It's social media and all the attendant challenges that are in that. I'm not diminishing those challenges. It's changed how we entertain ourselves in some respects because of streaming video. But that part of our economy, the parts of our economy that are information-centric, banking, mm-hmm. investing advice, entertainment and news, those parts of our economy are less than 20% of the GDP. It's about 15% of the gross domestic product. The rest of the economy, how we make and move stuff, all those things, they've been largely undigitalized, and that's where the transformation is going to come next and has already begun. And that's why I say it's revolutionary, because the we call it the efficacy of entertainment, right? How easy it is to see a movie. Okay, it's disrupted the movie industry, and everybody talks about a lot of the conveniences. We stream shows now. It's really transformed that industry. But that industry is a share of the total economy. It's really small. But imagine those transformations coming to the rest of the economy. That's what's happening. That's what's coming next. And that will be 99% good because it's productive. But the 1%, the disruption side, some of those things are challenging. I mean, that's why we are having these debates about so-called fake news and who could control censorship in that space of what the cloud has done. These are important debates to have. I think we'll sort these things out in America because of the nature of our country. But that doesn't mean that they're easy or trivial problems that have occurred because of the sort of structural transformation in our information systems.
When we go back to the smartphone, for example, you talk about that in the book, the things that had to occur in tandem to make that such a powerful new tool in our kit. You needed the microprocessing Yep. capability. You needed the lithium battery. You needed the smaller screens. And they all converge. Now, you're talking about a similar convergence here. And you also remind us that even when a technology has been around, and we might think of it as ho-hum, or we might think that its various applications have all been exhausted. That's just about the time when the people who really innovate and make change figure out new kind of economy bursting ways to make this stuff really impactful, as you say, in the 80% of the economy now untouched generally by the cloud. So help us to understand that.
So that's a really important point, and it's what I try to drive home in my book, is that revolutions don't come from just an invention per se. It wasn't just the transistor that changed computing, right? It was a constellation of things that had occurred, first to make the transistor possible, and then to make the transistor become the integrated circuit, then the microprocessor. These are evolutionary things, in a sense, that require contemporaneous revolutions in other areas. In the case of the microprocessor and the smartphone, we had to invent the kinds of machines that made it possible to build the things in the first place. So, I mean, that's true for the airplane. You think about the airplane as we know it today, required the invention not only of the jet engine, it required also the development of the metallurgy of aluminum, because you know, steel planes are just kind of heavy. And it also required the evolution in a whole area of information that we now call weather forecasting, which didn't exist as a discipline or service prior to the dawn of commercial aviation. So that's the pattern of history. So I'll give a specific example of some things today that I think are on the cusp of big changes that we already are familiar with. Drones and robots. I mean, let's deal in the mechanical world. There are similar examples in healthcare and entertainment, but everybody knows about drones. Drones, you know, came on the scene only about 20 years ago as a practical product for commercial use, and now they're proliferated not just as toys, but they're used by insurance companies rather than climbing on ladders. Use a drone to look at roof damage, all these kinds of things. But the drone as a useful tool, say, to carry medicines to remote areas or products to deliver them in ex-urban and rural areas, requires sort of a revolution both in the materials, the communications with them to make them safe and reliable, and also the propulsion system. So for small drones, the lithium battery, for bigger drones, the hybrid system, just like hybrid cars, batteries and engines. We are on the cusp of a revolution in the distribution of goods because of drones. But people have gotten sort of inured to it because it's early on hype, you know, about.
Right, about Amazon delivering their packages. I can feel it. I mean, if you read this book, The Cloud Revolution, at a time like this, it's going to give you some inspiration, some hopefulness. It really does. And you say that the specialized path that we're on is going to gift us with a boom. And you say that 25% in the near future will live like the 5% today, and the future 5% will live like today's 1%, and so on. Now, we have seen a lot of changes in our society technologically, even up to this point, maybe none as convulsive as what you see happening with the cloud. But we have seen winners and we've seen losers. You say, though, that the rising tide should lift, in some sense, all boats. There might be some people who are skeptical about that.
And the skepticism is not without justification. I mean, so the rising tide does lift all boats. That's no question about it. That's because society has become wealthier. And history has shown us that the way that people live, the way the 10% lived 50 years ago is how 80% of the population live today. That pattern is sort of locked into history. It sort of makes sense. But there are, you know, these are not perfect transitions. They're not everybody's a winner. The Luddite story, which is still enshrined in history, you know, the Luddites who were the hand weavers and were displaced by the automated loom, right? And they revolted and protested. Well, the Luddites were right. They did lose their jobs, right? I mean, that's true. They were displaced. That's what they were unhappy about. Society generated more jobs, cheaper clothing, but the people who did that old job lost their jobs. That's a standard pattern. And in fact, I'll state a fact that I found fascinating and put it in my book, is that if you look at the kinds of jobs that existed in the 1960s, which is not that long ago, roughly 60% of the kinds of jobs that existed then don't exist as jobs today. Well, draftsmen don't do the kind of, using pencils on the drafting table. You know, not many tellers left in banks. And you go to the list of things, telephone operators. So those kinds of things make sense. The question that is a challenge for society is how do you manage the disruption for those who are disrupted? How do you find first safety nets, which is unemployment insurance, retraining? How do you find new jobs? How do you get reskilled? How do you redirect your children? My point, I think, is that for the first time in history, we have another tool to deal with that. The first tool is wealth. If we're a wealthy society, we could afford to provide safety nets. Poor societies don't have safety nets because they're not wealthy, obviously. So that's the tool. Technology creates that tool because it creates wealth. But now for the first time, we have a tool that makes it easier for people who are on the, we'll call it the displaced category, to find new work, simplistically. It's easy to find job postings in neighboring areas using the internet and the cloud, rather than having to subscribe to 20 papers in remote areas, which is what you would have to have done, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It's also much easier to get new skills training online and tutoring online. Obviously, that's we proved that with the, I'll call them crazy lockdowns of 2 years. We figured out for certain kinds of education, that's good. It's not good for most education, especially children, but for reskilling people, for tutoring, remote learning is extraordinarily powerful. And then I'll add a third feature, which is cloud-driven, because many of the skilled trades that one would want to learn, and this is where we have a shortage of employees, we have a surplus of jobs and a surfeit of skilled, you know, labor. How do you train people? How do you train people remotely? Well, you know, I'm not a huge fan of this phrase, the metaverse, because I don't even use it in my book because I think it's both distracting and confusing, but for a lot of reasons. And I get why Zuckerberg chose metaverse. I mean, but augmented and virtual reality are extraordinarily powerful tools, not for just entertainment, but for training. If you think about what goes into learning a skill, you have to be in the environment, see the things that you're doing, and you have to experience it physically, like an apprentice or you train. You still have to do that, but if you can augment it first with a virtual trainer, a simulator, you can learn the skill faster. We know that's true because that's how aviation has evolved to become so safe, which, of course, are the simulators, the trainers that are used for all pilots. Bringing that technology, democratizing that technology for all skills, which is what AR and VR, augmented reality, virtual reality permit, combined with the cloud, is revolutionary in a way that is, in a way, unprecedented in history. Extraordinarily optimistic for reskilling and learning new skills, optimistic for the disruption in the workforce that's created by the natural progress of technology. So in a sense, for the first time in history, the technologies that are disrupting the workforce are also the technologies, which is the cloud largely, that enhance our ability to deal with the disruption that that technology creates. That's never happened before. The invention of the car didn't help people who were displaced in the horse and buggy industry. It didn't help them at all. I mean, they could certainly go try to work for Ford, but it didn't help them. Whereas the cloud, which disrupts people the same way the car did, that cloud is a tool that helps people who are disrupted. This is really quite different. It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Now, let's talk about the robots. A lot of people are really concerned. All the robots are coming to take my job, and, you know, I'm not happy about that. Now, you, of course, talk about an openness here, both to markets, to new ways of doing things, to allowing humans to really embark on really the things we like to do, that we do better than any robot. We can be more interesting in terms of our work. We can be more creative. I mean, you see this being allowing and freeing and giving us opportunities that we as humans, rather than the drudgery of a job, the potential and the excitement of various new forms of work, or even just going back to the things we'd rather retain as a human activity.
There's a sort of a cartoonish misunderstanding of artificial intelligence and robots going on. It really is. And you're right. I'm deeply optimistic about what it means for both the productivity of our economy, which means it's wealth creating, the democratizing of work, and the increasing ability to make work more interesting and safe. So let's put it in the two buckets. I think of artificial intelligence in the cloud as a virtual robot, which it is, right? It's giving you advice about an idea. So that's what an AI does. And a physical robot helps you with a physical task, whether it's a walking robot or a wheeled machine that does something. But first, definitionally, the idea that a machine, whether it's a virtual machine doing advice in the cloud or a physical machine, automating a human task, that that's a bad thing, it's just profoundly misguided. Does everybody want to go back to pencil and paper to do calculations again? I mean, adding machine and spreadsheets certainly made that a lot easier. We used to employ rooms full of people who were called, this is the origin of the word, computers. They were people in rooms full of people, accountants and computers, who would do calculations by hand. Now a machine does that, and nobody laments that. Right? In fact, would you? It's good to learn how to do arithmetic with pencil and paper, but you don't want to spend your life doing that. It's nicer to have the machine do it. Similarly, no one is lamenting the advent of the backhoe rather than having to dig a trench with a shovel. That automated machine is far more productive. So those two ideas epitomize the evolution that we're now seeing happen, and they're causing this kind of bizarre view. First of all, artificial intelligence isn't. By that I mean, it's like calling a car an artificial horse or an airplane an artificial bird. We're not making machines that are intelligent in the sense that we know what intelligence is, or even we don't really know what intelligence is. In fact, the right phrase, which is now being adopted in the engineering community, is intelligent automation. So the machine that has software that can react to the environment that's around it with vision cameras and sensors is a more intelligent automated machine. For example, if you have a backhoe that's automated, you wouldn't want it to hit people. You'd want it to be smart enough to see people, sense them, and not hit them if it's working in the same environment as you're working in. But now you don't have to operate the backhoe. You got to do something else, just as if you don't have to use a shovel. You've got to use a backhoe. Those kinds of conceptual misunderstandings of what automation means sort of are running rampant in the general punditocracy today. Whereas what really is happening is we're enhancing the ability for people to make decisions or be creative because we have artificial intelligence that speeds up pattern recognition and gives advice to doctors about the pathology report, right? Or, you know, in dangerous work, which construction trade always is, or mining, all these essential industries, we definitely want to increase automation there, but we don't eliminate people. In fact, we have a shortage of people willing and able to work in those spaces. Automation of this kind, the true robot, couldn't come at a more important time. We have both the demographic shift and the aging out, silver tsunami of the workforce, but we have growth globally growing faster than the ability for the old industries to provide the essential products and services. So the robot and there's a technical term for this, created a couple decades ago by a couple of professors at Northwestern that I know. They called it a cobot, a collaborative robot, which already exists. These are robots that could look like be anthropomorphic. They can walk and accompany you into environments. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Obviously, it's a good thing. It's not going to replace labor in the sense of eliminate jobs so there's no more work. The way you put it is correct, is that what it does is it allows humans to upskill to do what they would like to do or are better at in collaboration with the machine. In this case, the machine is not a backhoe. It might be an automated backhoe, but it also could be literally what looks like an anthropomorphic robot. You know, Spot Mini, the Boston Dynamics robotic dog, is a commercial product now. And what is it doing? Well, it's not fetching balls. Primarily, the job it's given on construction sites and mine sites is safety related, because it can operate in the same environment as people because it's anthropomorphic. You walk around, follow, and it's looking for indications of safety hazards, let's just say. It's doing the monitoring and the safety work that people do as well, but people miss things. And if we can improve safety and move the person doing that job to something else, productivity goes up, safety goes up, and we still do the thing that's essential, in this case, you know, whether it's mining or farming. Probably the fastest penetration of robots in the way we think of them from science fiction land you know, robots that can walk around and do things. The fastest penetration of robots that's going on in the world today, interestingly enough, falls in two domains. Agriculture, we shouldn't be surprised at that. Farmers embraced automation and tractors way before. Engines went into farming before they went on the roads. I mean, you can imagine why.
Yeah.
It's tough work. And warehouses, the things that we love about one-click shopping, involve the cloud, of course, because it makes all that shopping easy, but it also involves massive increase in warehouses that distribute the products in a hyper-efficient, hyper-precise way. And warehouses are increasingly filled with robots doing that job because they can do it faster and better, and there aren't enough people to do those jobs. And it's an explosion of new kinds of robots. Not just one of the first robots in a warehouse was what looked like a turtle. It's a company that Amazon bought, no surprise there, right, about 15 years ago, called Kiva. And they made a robot that will lift up, you know, racks of boxes and move it around the factory to where it should be in an automated fashion. But there are also now robots that literally pick up boxes and take them out of a truck and put them on the conveyor instead of having a person do it. There's a shortage of truck drivers. It's a better job for the person if they get trained up to drive the truck rather than empty the boxes from the truck, which, of course, takes us to the question, it's got to be in everybody's mind, well, what about robo-trucks? Right? Well, if that eliminates your job, well, not easily, not on highways. I write about this in my book. It's much harder than people think. But in industrial environments, in mine sites, you know, and off-road where you're in a construction environment, yeah, robots are already driving trucks in mine sites all over the world, have been for a decade or so.
It is so remarkable, I mean, to hear the way you're putting these various things together that are so disparate in our minds. You say the more that machines roar, the more that the economy will, and you say that there is this mistaken belief that there are limits to the planet's tolerance for human flourishing. And then you talk about the fact that the one thing that is the most precious of all commodities is time. What will this do to our ability to enjoy our lives, to have that work-life balance? And you did reference the pandemic earlier. This has hastened a lot of what you are predicting about the roaring 2020s, has it not?
It has. I mean, it's had enormous destructive effects on the economy and a lot of people's lives, so I don't minimize that. But a good example of what the lockdowns did is they hastened the obvious benefit of remote medicine, where you should be able to talk to your doctor without having to go to the clinic and do it remotely. That was illegal, and we eliminated that. And it doesn't mean you still shouldn't go to a doctor or a hospital, but it certainly is far more productive and efficient to be able to connect with a physician or a nurse remotely. And what's coming next, and this is what's been accelerated by the pandemic's push to do early detection of all classes of viruses and bacteria, is remote detection, that we know that detectors exist that are sort of companions to smartphones that can allow you to do, we'll call it self-diagnosis, but it would be a diagnosis that would connect, again, remotely with your doctor or your
nurse. On your Apple phone or whatever it may be, I mean, or your watch, I mean, you can send back all this data through the cloud to your doctor, who can monitor your situation.
Well, to go back to the advice portion of it, as most people know, the smartwatches and phones can do heart rate and blood pressure and a variety of important basic metabolic measurements. And an AI engine, the intelligent automation, will know the patterns of your behavior, and it's not going to needlessly alert you or your physician just based on raw data, but rather look at patterns and say, oh, you probably should look at this now because it's out of the normal realm for you. So it's hyper-specific medicine. So what I see coming now, and partly accelerated by the lockdowns and the pandemic, is a increased awareness of an appetite for, we'll call it automating the healthcare system, which desperately needs new technology. And you're right, I put in my book this notion that what we try to do broadly in society is we try to preserve the most important thing in the universe. And I'm being sort of philosophically hyperbolic. It's the number of hours that human beings are given as an opportunity to live. there's no limit to physical resources. There's no limit to energy in any practical way. These things aren't limited. They are just a question of technology. What's limited is how many hours we get to live in theory, each of us. And it turns out it's an interesting number. It's 1,000,000 hours. The maximum lifespan for human beings is 1,000,000 hours. That's 114 years, by the way. The percentage of people who get to closer to that has been increasing over the last two centuries entirely because of technology. And what we want to do is, I mean, all of us want this. We would like to increase the prospect that we can live most of those 1,000,000 hours and live them in a healthy fashion, which isn't just a reduction of a burden on society, but it's also a more pleasant way to live, obviously. And that's a technology factor, both in terms of how we diagnose, how we monitor, how we invent drugs and therapies, and all of those things. As soon as I say those, you know, just intuitively, that all of that is made easier and better by the kind of computational power in the cloud, the connectivity, the sensors on the edge. And even when we have injuries and we think about, well, what do you do for therapeutics and recovery when you have had an injury? Well, it turns out cobots and robots and exoskeletons are all the kinds of tools that help recovery and retraining of limbs and replacement of things like, you know, the prosthetic world where there's people have tragically lost limbs. The radical improvement in prosthetics that's now underway is astonishing. And again, it's all related to the same constellation of technologies that the cloud has sort of birthed. Probably there's no single thing that I'm more optimistic about in the 2020s and the 30s is the transformation that's coming in medical care, medical awareness. The challenge we'll have with that is like everything else, we have to, it will intersect the resistance of the extant infrastructures to adapt. It doesn't mean it's going to just flow out painlessly, no pun intended, into our lives. It will take some adjustments in how we regulate, how we, you know, ensure, how we, you know, permit innovation to happen in health.
I do want to say that Mr. Mills makes it very clear in the book that we don't all have to be technocrats to benefit from what is coming. In fact, far from it, that a lot of this is going to make our lives a lot better and easier without understanding all that's underpinning this change, which he understands so profoundly. You say the 2020s boom will center on the democratization of the technologies of knowledge manifested in the cloud. And again, a reminder of what he said earlier, the cloud is as different from the internet as the later was different from telephony. So we've got really profound changes. Just in closing, because you've given us a lot of your time, and you've got to read this book, you really do, The Cloud Revolution. But just help people understand the concretization of this concept. In other words, you talk about these data centers that are the invisible flagships for the 21st century. They are real. They're being built, whether you can see it or not. They're huge. Yeah. They're taking up a lot of energy, but they are really affording us this expansive future that you see for us.
Yeah, they're the sort of the beating heart, if you like, of the massive cloud infrastructure. But let me quickly emphasize a point you made about you don't need to be technically skilled to take advantage of what the cloud will offer, or what the future brings, or put in the terms that we've been, you know, bludgeoned with so often. You don't have to be a coder to have a future job. In fact, there won't be any more coders in the future than there are farmers today. Both are essential. Both essential. It just won't be. Trust me, that's the way the coders are really good at automating their own job, like farmers are good at automating their jobs.
By the way, as it relates to farmers, I love the there's an ad out for Moink, and she says, you know, we have a math problem. Only 2% of us are farmers, but 100% of us like to eat. So somehow that works, but how does that work? And as you say, we're going to make more efficient all these processes so fewer people have to be coding or farming to get us what we need.
Well, in fact, the how it all works is called technology and science. And that's exactly what you'd want. You don't want poor economies. Everybody has to farm. That's the progress in history has been exactly to permit only a couple of percentage points of society to be employed in production of food. And frankly, the same for fuel and energy. But the data centers are interesting as the sort of the beating heart. These are buildings, you know, the word data center, think about that. It'd be like calling the Empire State Building an office center, you know. It's no different than any other office center. It's a pretty impressive structure when they first built it, and they're still pretty impressive. Which we have a special name for them. We call them skyscrapers. We don't have a special name for data centers. They, you know, it's kind of weird. And there's more data centers in square feet and in dollars and in tons than there are skyscrapers in the world, and they're growing at a far faster rate. These are buildings the size of a Walmart or a shopping mall, literally, filled with computers and communications devices that are sort of the heart of the computational function, if you like, and storage function for the cloud. And they comprise sort of, I would say simplistically, sort of a third of the ecosystem, because you have to have communications networks. You have to have the end-use devices. So those are the three, your smartphones and the sensors, the wireless and wired networks, and at the center of it all, these giant data centers. But it, we're building, let me put this in sort of, again, dollar and physical space terms. Data centers are like real estate buildings, big buildings. They're millions of square feet. We're building data centers globally now at the rate of something on the order of 10 to 20 million square feet per year of these kinds of buildings at a far faster rate than we're building skyscrapers. And, of course, a data center, interestingly enough, costs about as much to build per square foot as a skyscraper, but we're building far more of them. And to your point about energy, a data center uses about 100 times more energy per square foot than a skyscraper. In fact, I'll put it in a different way. A square foot of data center uses one square foot. Remember, we're building them by the millions of square feet a year. It uses more electricity each year than does 1,000 Tesla electric cars. So you've got this incredibly interesting, huge energy-consuming infrastructure. But what's more important about it is that each square foot of a data center has more compute power than the whole world has. Just 40, 50 years ago. So this is why when you look at the prospects for revolutions, if you just look at the input side, we're adding to society this computational inferential, and I keep coming back to the inference part, not the computational part, the advice-giving part, this massive infrastructure that's hidden from daily sight, but you have access to it, not just through smartphones, but literally embedded into the background of how we do things like healthcare or how we do news and entertainment. And we take it for granted, and we should. But taking it for granted doesn't, you know, it's sort of why I try to illuminate it in my book. It's a mistake to take it for granted in terms of both the potential, which I think is why we should be optimistic about the future, but also the challenges. And I don't spend a lot of time on the challenges in the book, because otherwise it would have been an 800-page book instead of a 400-page book. But the challenges are not trivial, politically, structurally. But to deal with them, to deal with the political implications of what we're doing in this sort of broad revolution that's just beginning, I think one has to appreciate why we should have why we should not just be optimistic, but why it's important to get the resolution done correctly, why it's important not to, you know, think about the tech giants as just bad actors. There are some bad actors in them as people, but the technologies they're using, most of these people are doing something extraordinarily important, vital to our economy, much more important than just doing social media, frankly. But that doesn't mean those other features of what we're struggling with, you know, making sure we don't have censorship that's inappropriate. That's really important to get right too. I mean, I write about that in my introduction and in my epilogue. Those are important things to get right. We have to fight those fights. These are political, not technological fights, but most of these fights are derivative from technology changing. Right? We can look back through history. That's a pretty common pattern. You might call me naive for being optimistic we'll resolve these things on the political side, but, you know, I'm Canadian. I immigrated to America because I think it's a unique political and social culture, and this country has solved these problems many times over the last couple centuries, and there have been very similar problems in terms of disruption.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to call you naive. I want to call you right, because I've got children and grandchildren who depend upon you being correct. And I've got to tell you, you really caught my attention And we're always looking at trends here on this podcast. And clearly, you have given us a way forward that I think a lot of people mired in the moment will find hard to believe, but we're unlocking it day by day. I mean, there are so many things that are going on. And one of the things is, you know, the skyscraper, as you say, was visible to all of us. We could see the FW Woolworth building going up or the Empire State. We can't see these things. And yet we know intrinsically that they are already benefiting our lives, even though the applications for which they are now being used might be so first stage, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for your generosity of time and knowledge. And please pick up this book, The Cloud Revolution, How the Convergence of New Technologies Will Unleash the Next Economic Boom and a Roaring 2020s. Mark Mills, it is really worth your time. Thanks again for being with us on America Trends.